Like the conversations you hear on Basic Folk with your favorite roots artists? Then join Back Catalog Listening Party, a weekly podcast where you can dig deeper into their catalog. Top songwriters like Mary Gaucher, Chris Smither, Dar Williams, and Lizzie No join host Mother Banjo and Anthony Earig to talk about their old albums with a live online audience. Listen wherever you get your podcasts and learn about attending live tapings at backcataloglisteningparty.com/join. Hi, and welcome to Basic Folk, where we have honest conversations with folk musicians on the Bluegrass Situation Podcast Network. I'm Cindy Howes, and thanks for checking out the pod today. It's very exciting. Couple reasons why. It's the first episode of 2025. Also, we have the legendary Jerry Douglas on, the world's greatest dobro player. And it's the first episode where we've featured our new Basic Folk theme song. And you'll hear lots of new segue music throughout the episode as well. That's all courtesy of our good friend Dietrich Strauss. It is a new day here at Basic Folk. You also may have noticed we have a new logo and new branding on our social media graphics. We have officially become a production of the Bluegrass Situation. And I want to thank everyone at BGS for making it happen. Thanks to Amy Reitnauer Jacobs, Shelby Williamson, Justin Hiltner, and everybody at BGS. We are so excited and really thrilled to be part of the Bluegrass Situation family. Okay, before we get into Jerry Douglas, I just want to let you know there are a couple different ways that you can support Basic Folk. One is by sharing with a friend or family member. That's the best way to get the word out about this folk podcast. We are still a grassroots operation despite being partnered with the Bluegrass Situation. So anything you can do to share with your friends and family would be awesome. You can also stay in touch with us. And the best way to do that is to join our monthly newsletter list. And you can find that link in the show notes or go to basicfolk.com. You can also follow us on social media at Basic Folk Pod. We're on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and TikTok. And finally, if you're really enjoying the show and have been for a while, you'll know that we're a listener-supported operation, so people giving $5 or $10 a month, one-time gifts of $100, really does help us out and help us pay our producers and our website costs and our streaming operations. So if you want to do that, that would be awesome. If you don't have the means or don't really feel like doing it, that's cool to just to sit back and listen as well. You can find information on how to contribute at basicfolk.com or check out the show notes. Okay, Jerry Douglas. He is widely regarded as the best dobro player in the world. Alison Krauss, Emmylou Harris, and James Taylor are counted among his many collaborators. His four-decade career has earned him 16 Grammy Awards and numerous other accolades. In our conversation, he shares stories about his upbringing in Warren, Ohio, where his father's steel mill job and love for music instilled in him a strong work ethic and passion for playing. He also talks about getting scouted as a teenager by the Country Gentlemen, one of the greatest bluegrass bands ever, who eventually took young Jerry on tour. Jerry discusses his latest album, The Set, which showcases his mastery of the resophonic guitar and features a unique blend of bluegrass, country, and Americana sounds. He also opens up about his experiences working as producer with Molly Tuttle, John Hyatt, and other notable musicians, highlighting the importance of collaboration and creative freedom. The conversation offers a glimpse into Jerry's life, influences, and artistic approach through his humility, humor, and dedication to his craft. Okay, let's take a listen to a song from his new album, The Set, which features music previously released by Jerry. These are songs that he enjoys performing live, and he kind of re-recorded them and put them all in one place. This is a song featuring Jerry Douglas on vocals. It's Something You Got, and then we'll get to our conversation with Jerry Douglas on Basic Folk.
Something you've got, baby, makes me work all day. Something you got, baby, makes me bring home my pain. something you got, baby. You ought to know. I said,
Jerry Douglas, thanks for coming on Basic Folk. It's an honor.
Oh, thank you for having me. Thanks for putting up with the uproar of getting me on here. But I'm very happy to be here. Thank you.
Great. Well, I'm excited, first of all, to talk about where you grew up, which is firmly settled in the Rust Belt of Warren, Ohio. I lived in Pittsburgh for 15 years. I'm not from Pittsburgh, but I am familiar with the general vibe that is Western Pennsylvania and Eastern Ohio. Your dad worked at the steel mill, and there is a certain unique grit that people of that area and of that vocation, which is very dwindling vocation, inhibit. So how did your dad, who moved from West Virginia to Warren, Ohio, fit into that mold of the steel worker? And how has that mold impacted you?
Well, I think thanks for the question. I mean, it's not an often asked one. I think he came up from West Virginia like so many people did for work. You know, there was no work in West Virginia. You were either a coal miner or you worked on the state road if your political party was in office that year, and or you were a farmer. And he wanted a better life. He went to the Navy, came back. He had a cousin up in Warren, Ohio, who said, come on up, I can get you a job on the steel mill up here. And that's what everybody was doing. And there was this whole flood exodus out of the South up into taking those jobs and those steel jobs. And he also found guys up there. He created a band out of all guys from West Virginia at one point who were all steel workers. And they were good, and they could have been anything, but they were already steel workers with families, so they were kind of stuck.
Yeah. Mm. So was he into that, did he fit into the grit of a steel mill worker?
He did, very much. I mean, he was fresh out of the Navy, too, so he had a chip on his shoulder. And where my father worked, there were so many different nationalities represented there that you could everybody got along, you know, and they were all there for the same reason, to find work. And it was a gritty bunch of people. I mean, we played, when I got into his band and started playing in his band, we worked in this dive bar right across the street from Alcoa.
That's another steel mill, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, there were three major steel mills in Warren, and then Youngstown Sheet and Tube, and they all went down about the same time. I remember my dad coming home and saying, "Our days are numbered. Japanese steel is taking over, and it won't be long until we'll be."
Heartbreaking.
You know, yeah. And as I said, they were a gritty bunch of people, and they would pour out of Alcoa steel mill late at night on a Saturday night, and I would be inside playing with my dad's band and stand up on the stage. We didn't have any chicken wire, but there were a few times I wish we did.
You know, right. My God.
It got weird in there sometimes, but mostly it was just a bunch of people having a good time. Anyway, that's down the road.
I bet we could swap stories, because by the time I got to Pittsburgh, it's sort of like the steel mill worker was a thing of the past, a legend, as you might say. So in Pittsburgh, I don't know if this is the case where you grew up, but there were lots of bathrooms in the basement. The Pittsburgh toilet and the Pittsburgh shower is a thing. And the legend has it that the steel mill worker would come home immediately like go into the house through the basement and clean up before he went upstairs.
Yeah.
Into the rest of the house.
I remember the smell of his jacket when he would come in through the utility room and hang his jacket up and his hat, you know, and take off his boots down there. I remember that the smell of the mill, you know, the metallic kind of thing. And I made the thing about Pittsburgh is, isn't it amazing what a cleanup job?
Yeah.
I mean, I went to a baseball game once. And so the old Three River Stadium saw Roberto Clemente, Willie Stargell, these guys that night saw them play.
I'm getting goosebumps.
That'll raise the hackles on every Pittsburgh fan. And those were the days, man.
Yeah.
And I remember going in there thinking, this is the dirtiest place I've ever seen. I live in Warren, Ohio. I didn't think it could be topped, but this is awful. Mm. And then going back there now to play and to visit people and just drive around the city, it's amazing what they did. It's amazing what you can do. Mm. And that place is proof.
Now, the second part of my question about the mold of the steel worker, like how do you feel like that grit continues to follow you through your life?
There's a work ethic involved. Hard work, you know, you don't let a setback set you back. You fight through it, you know, even learning to play the guitar or any instrument. And dobro, I remember I would get to these plateaus and I would just go, I can't be any better than this. This is as good as it's going to get. But the more I played and the more I played, I forced it. I played and I jumped out of that ditch that I was in. Mm. And that's been like everything in my life has been that way. And I'm pretty sure it came from him and all those people that I met up there. You know, they were rough beer joint, you know, beer drinking, hard working fellows. They didn't, nothing was given to them, nothing.
So you're in Nashville now. You are a professional musician. You're one of the greatest living musicians of our time.
So you say.
So well, I read it a lot on the internet. However, your musical origins were more based in socializing and playing for pleasure and playing for just playing sake with your dad, like being a part of your dad's band and also just watching your dad and watching him play. Like, how has your first experience of performance and your observation of your dad's musicality, like based on socializing and playing for enjoyment, how has that influenced the type of musician you've been?
Completely. I remember playing, you know, we would go to West Virginia to visit the grandparents or on the family reunions and everything. And there Dad and I would take he'd take his guitar. I'd take a dobro, whatever I was had to play at that point. And they'd say, and you've heard them say that, did you bring your music with you? Did you bring your music with you? And that meant, you know, are you going to play us a tune, you know? And so we'd get them out, you know, and we'd play three or four tunes and then they'd all walk away and we'd put them back in the cases. You know, that's all they wanted, really. But even so after that, and I'm a kid, before I was even playing dobro, I remember being a kid rolling around on the floor watching my dad's band rehearse. So I was watching these guys and I was taking it in. They were trying to figure out where the verse and the chorus was and who was going to play what and who was going to sing what. And, you know, and I'm laying there on the floor watching this and it's what I do now, mm-hmm. basically. Mm-hmm. So that was a pretty lucky draw. And just, you know, and after that, you know, these guys were really good and they could have told me to just buzz off, you know, in the band, the other guys in his band. But they were, you know, very helpful to me. Very, very helpful.
For sure.
Taught me tunes. You know, the reason I play, a lot of the reason I play the way I play is because of the banjo player and the violin player, the fiddle player that he had at the time, Ray Spinoggle and Harry Schaefer, who played fiddle tunes with me. And made me play all the notes in the melody, not just glaze it and, you know, blast, blow through the changes.
Yeah.
Because I didn't know how to do that.
Yeah.
You know, what I learned first was the melody. And that's still, if you can't play the melody, you have no business improvising.
Hmm.
You know, you should, you learn the melody because you're improvising over that melody and you're creating, you know, all these other things. But they taught me to play, how to play fiddle tunes in open G and then open A. And one of them, the fiddle player, even made me a capo for my dobro. And out of a huge metal, you know, like an electrode, brass electrode, that big, he machined this thing down.
Got something from work.
Oh, yeah.
Brought home something from work.
Oh, and it worked. It worked. It worked. You know, there was a little science involved about graduating from a 56,000ths down to a 16,000ths. But, you know, we figured that out, too. But it was all like a science fair project. Me learning how to play this guitar.
Yeah.
Nobody even knew what it was up there. You know, I'd go to a music store and they'd say, oh, what? You know, until I finally, I got a brochure when Dobro started building Dobros again in 1967. There was a company took it up and I had a brochure and I took it to the music store and they went, oh, this is what this kid's been talking about all this time. Yeah, let's order him one. And so... So that was the first real Dobro I ever had. And that was the one that I took with me into the first professional gig I had. So, you know, I graduated up through the guitar world's brands of guitars from there.
Wow. Amazing.
There's so much that I learned at their feet, basically.
Also, it must have been so incredible to have that kind of like attention from adults who are taking you seriously.
Yeah, I wasn't even thinking about that. I mean, it was kind of, yeah, I guess it was strange for them to be doing, but it didn't seem that odd to me at the time. I mean, we were kind of like, we were always treated nice. You know, I don't remember anything other than that. So, yeah, but I see what you mean. I get your point. And yeah, it was great that they were nice to me and let me play along.
You've called yourself like an introvert who can speak in front of thousands of people, have a good time at a party, but you say when I'm alone, I'm really alone, but in a positive way. So what did that look like for you growing up? And how did playing music help you discover this about yourself?
I discovered that I was quiet. I knew that I never wanted to offer up a bunch of opinions, you know? Even when I was a little kid, I was happy being alone. I had a little brother who was like 2.5 years younger than me, who was like a shadow, but he wasn't, you know, I don't remember him being an interference at any point, but yeah, I knew I was the quiet kid. I was the quiet kid. And I was the one who was at the party and everybody's having a great time. And I think I'm supposed to be, but I can't. So that's how I grew up. But like I said, I'm comfortable standing in a safe place on a stage talking to however many people. Doesn't matter. It's okay. You know, it's a strange thing, but yeah, music really let me release a lot of things, a lot of feelings, a lot of emotions that I didn't know how to let go of as a kid, I suppose. And I'm pretty lucky that I had music or I'd probably be incarcerated somewhere.
Also, I wonder, like, being around adults, like, a lot of the time, like, you were on the road with Country Gentlemen, hugely influential and popular bluegrass band when you were 16, yeah. 17, 18, and those guys are about twice your age.
Yeah.
You started session work, like, as a teenager, do you think being around like older, like how do you think being around those older professionals like impacted your playing, impacted your professionalism?
I just leapfrogged over a lot of time. When I joined the Country Gentlemen, they were the cream of the crop. You know, they were everybody wanted to hear them. And in comes this kid, and, you know, I finally learned to play into the microphone and not just close to it, you know, so I could be heard. And after you know, Doyle Lawson or somebody gave me a shove from behind, you know. So, but I learned a lot. I learned, you know, I'm a Rhodes Scholar, you know, but not the good kind. But but I think I was really lucky to fall into that bunch of guys, because they did have morals, you know, and I felt respect there. And in fact, the way that I joined that band was I was playing a festival with my dad's band, and they were playing the same festival. It was up in Ohio, up there close to Warren somewhere. And I looked out in the audience and I saw Charlie Waller standing over here and Bill Emerson here and Doyle Lawson over there. And I thought, I'm being scouted like a baseball player, you know, or something.
Were you excited about that, or were you?
It kind of freaked me out a little bit at first, because just seeing them, you know, I was just so I was in such a hero worship phase with them anyway, that.
Sure.
And then right after the show, you know, they came back and they're talking, they go, can you leave with us tonight? Can you go with us?
That's insane.
And I no, I can't. I got a junior year in high school. You know, I'm about to go into my junior year of high school. I need to go to school, you know. And so between my junior and senior years of high school, I did join their band and went out on for the summer and played with them through the summer and missed summer practice for football. So I couldn't play my senior year of football after, and what a crushing blow to a young male ego, you know. But
is that a joke or is that for real?
That's for real. That you know,
because if it was football, like everything in Warren.
Oh yeah, football and basketball. Yeah, we had the Warren Western Reserve. We had the Browner brothers. You know, they all these guys ended up playing in the pros. I certainly was not going to at 165 pounds soaking wet, and I've made up for that ever since. But I knew that wasn't my vocation, but it was another way to me to put on these pads and run down the field as fast as you can and run into somebody. Really felt good to me. I mean, it liberated me in another way. You know, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody. I was expected they were doing the same thing I was doing. But, you know, it instilled in me, though, that music is a contact sport as well. And it's a team sport, very much a team sport.
Yeah.
And you want to feel that. You want to feel that from your bandmates. You know, you want to feel that. You know, you've got my back, you know, and I've got your back, you know, through whatever, you know, right now we're glued together, you know, that kind of thing. It doesn't have to be forever. It's now.
It's kind of wild to think about. So you were starting to become a session musician and you went through the 70s, and 80s, 90s. You've played on over 2,000 albums and have produced many other albums, made your own records. The session musician stuff in particular makes me wonder, like, how did you keep it not just becoming a job? Like, how are you able to keep yourself creative and curious about your musicality versus just being about a gig that you like clock in and out for?
Well, you kind of go through phases with that. Sometimes you feel like, you know, this is the perfect job for me. I'm so happy to be, you know, being able to sleep in my own bed, you know, every night, but then go to work every day. And when I first started doing sessions, Music Row was really that. I mean, there were two streets and they were just loaded with recording studios and everybody was going day and night. And you could go down there and park your car and do three sessions and then walk back to your car and go home. You know, it was really jamming. And I did that for, boy, 10 years I was doing that, but I definitely went through some swings of, you know, I don't ever want to play another solo for the rest of my life. And I don't remember if I played this solo that I'm about to play on your song. I don't remember if I played it last week on somebody else's song, you know,
Oh,
that kind of stuff. When you start worrying about that, it's time to take a break, you know. And my luck, what fell out of the sky for me at that point was Alison Krauss calling me and saying, would you go out on the road with us for a couple of weeks so we can just honor these dates that we have, because one of the guys in the band just quit and we don't know whether we're going to go on and be a band anymore. And so I said, well, let me talk to Jill. And I called home and I called her back and said, yeah, I'll do it. Not thinking it was ever be a full-time thing. And about 4 days into it, though, they surrounded me and said, would you just stay? Would you stay? This is
what is it with you, Jerry?
I don't know.
People just want you to stay. They want to take you on the road.
Yeah. I'm the one that wants to move. But yep, it was wonderful, and it still is. Every time we play, it's that same magic feeling, and that's really, you know, corny to say and all that kind of stuff, but it's true. It's true.
We embrace corniness here.
Well, good.
You can be as corny. You can be as woo-woo.
I haven't gotten to woo. I may not get to woo-woo today.
No expectations.
No, but listening to that voice every night, you know, and those guys play, and how it all is so interlocking, and it's like a well-oiled machine, but it's beautiful, and it's mm-hmm. and it can be rough too, you know. It has its rough edges too. We make sure of it.
Yeah, working with Alison Krauss and also working with like really prominent artists in the 90s, you started working with people like Garth Brooks, Dolly Parton, Paul Simon. Is there any kind of like takeaways or differences you draw from working with like a more famous musician versus like the lesser known player playing at the beer joints and what have you?
Yeah, there's a difference. There's a difference, but it's more often than not, it's a very wonderful thing that happens is they turn out to be a really nice person. You know, somebody like James Taylor or Paul Simon don't have their longevity is not because they're an asshole, you know.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
They are nice. They're great guys. I'm glad I know them now and maybe not back in 1968 or something.
They've cooled down.
But I don't know what I would have been like then either, you know? So if I was them. But these people, Ray Charles and Garth Brooks is a really cool guy. He would get involved in the track, you know, he would get involved in the you know, I want to feel this here, you know, or all you guys, you know, he was a real hands-on approach, which I didn't expect. I figured I knew his producer, Alan Reynolds, and I knew Alan was a very laid back guy. So cool. And he would, Alan's comments would be, well, were you okay? Did you like that one? And then you're put on the spot, right? Then you go, you have to be really honest and go, nah, I think I need another one, you know? And Garth, and then that filtered through Garth, down through Garth. It was, they're a good tag team. And you find that with artists in there and their producers and their engineers, you know? There is a difference with working with the guys. You know, when I'd come home to play with my dad's band and go out and play a gig with them, I definitely felt the difference. You know, I felt, okay, but you know what? You are only as good as who you're playing with, really. I mean, you're only as good as the band or the people that you're playing with. You can be playing with, you know, monster Tony Rice and Bela and Sam in 1 minute, and then go back and just go out in the parking lot and play with a bunch of guys. And you can tell the difference. You know, there is a 10,000 hour or 20 or 30 or however many thousand it is. But what a difference it can make if you put in the time or you're gifted. It's different.
Mm. You've been producing records for quite a long time, over 40 years. I wanted to dig into a couple of your more recent producing roles. First of all, John Hiatt, Mm-hmm. You produced his record in 2021. The Jerry Douglas Band was his backing band for their album Leftover Feelings. I actually got a chance to talk to John on that album for the very first time ever. And no surprise, he's like a really sensitive, deeply emotional guy and was like very forthcoming in our conversation. And it's one of my favorites. But what kind of was surprising to me was how goofy he is. Like, he's like a real silly guy. Like, how did you sync up with John Hiatt's silliness, and how did it impact the mood and performances in the studio for Leftover Feelings?
I've known John for a long time, but what we had a really interesting conversation once backstage at the not Philly Folk Festival. It was at Newport Folk Festival, and I had seen a Little Village play with Ry Cooter and Nick Lowe and Jim, yeah, Keltner. And it was like seeing that genre version of Chick Corea and, you know, Light as a Feather with Stanley Clarke or something. Like, it was like you could compare the two bands. Were like they were on the same plane. They were just playing. They were just different genres. And I was having this conversation.
Can you explain that? Can you explain that a little bit more? It kind of goes over my head, well, that reference.
When you put John Hiatt told me that when he cut Bring the Family, he didn't know any of those musicians. He just asked a guy that he knew in Hollywood if he'd put together something that he could cut the record. And he just said, well, what's your wish list? And he gave him that. And that's who showed up. You know, it was Ry Cooter shows up and Nick Lowe, and just, wow, you know, couldn't find anybody good to play with that day. You know, it's like, but I'm saying what they did together and what musicianship and what talent and whatever goes into making brilliance, musical brilliance like that, is the same to me as if I'm listening to who was it that I just compared it to?
Chick Corea
in the original Return to Forever with Stanley Clarke and, you know, that band. It was like they both, when I saw both bands, my jaw dropped. You know, I couldn't believe what I was hearing. And then seeing Chick Corea play, Bela Fleck went with me. It was just me and Bela in this whole in Vanderbilt watching them, and we're both looking at each other like, this is some weird dream or something. This is not really happening. We just couldn't believe you could do that on an instrument, make that, you know, bring all those things out of a person. But I heard Little Village do the same thing to me, you know, in a different way. It might have not have hit Bela that way, but it did me, because, you know, I think I'm more of a fan of that kind of music, of Little Village, you know, and rock and roll, just dirty rock and roll like that, than I am of, you know, trying to be really sensitive and quiet. But I believe those two bands play on the same plane. You know, I believe they're on the same level. They're just, one band is just as good as the other in so many ways. Mm. They share so many things. And that's what I mean. Does that make any more sense?
Yeah, it does make a lot of sense. Bit.
They're at the top of their game where they're going to be in their life. But John started playing me songs, and one right after another, and he played me the one about his brother in the cornfield. Ugh. And all of that, and I just went, "Is John, was that your brother?" And he said, "Yeah," you know. And we talked a lot. I mean, from at that point, that's deep for me. I mean, that you know, a guy sharing something like that to the world, that's, he's learned how to let go.
Yeah.
You know, he's been through a lot in his life, and he's been through some terrible stuff, and he's had some great stuff. You know, he's been on the mountaintop and in the river, you know, so he knows a lot. And I really paid attention. I wanted to go to school on him and listen to him and learn from him. And we decided not to use drums, to go pretty light. I said, I'd really like to use my band because I really love the way they play. And I think that they'd be sensitive to these songs. I think they'd be great for these songs because they can get wild. They can get heavy. We can thrash, or we can be, you know, or we can pay homage to the song, you know. And so we didn't do it with drums. So from then on, I didn't have a drummer in my band either. I liked the sound of the record and the space in it. And so at that point, I lost drums in my band. But John is a funny, funny guy. We got out and we did a whole tour that started right like in August of 21. Mm-hmm. When we were playing to masked audiences, you know, and we were masked, we were bubbled, you know, three buses going down the road. We didn't see anybody but each other in the hotel room. You know, that was it. Mm-hmm. And we stayed. I still to this day have never had it. We did that and we did the tour, and then, you know, we both just kind of moved on to different, to other things. But I really treasure the time, you know, this little time capsule that I had with John.
Yeah.
And, you know, going through the whole thing of figuring out a record and making the record, you know, and which, you know, records are at least 100 hours for me, like if you started adding things up.
Well, I don't think anybody would mind if you made another one together.
I know. Well, I would. I would definitely. And we've talked about just the two of us doing duet. You're doing live duet shows. You know, just that would be fun.
Oh, I'd go. I'd do that. So your latest Grammy wins, correct me if I'm wrong, were producing Molly Tuttle and Golden Highway in 22 and 23.
Yeah.
Which
She's
is
amazing.
Such a great, another great combination. We talked to Molly and we talked about working with you as producer. And she told us that they would all laugh. The band would all laugh and chant to you, "Make us Acus" in the studio, Alison Krauss in Union Station.
Yeah. Make us Acus.
When you think of Molly and her band, how do you feel about like the next generation of bluegrass? And what have you been able to learn about the genre from working with Molly?
You know, working with Molly introduced me to Gen X, you know, and watching what I was saying or how I was saying it, you know, trying to.
You mean millennial?
Yes. I would slip a couple of times and say something that I might say to somebody that I knew in the 80s. And I asked Dom to play something simple once and back when I was recording with Emmylou Harris, Albert Lee would take a mandolin solo and we called it Chinese mandolin because it was much simpler than we just put a name on it just so we could remember it and say, do this. Mm-hmm. And that's not cool. I mean, it's not cool now. Mm-hmm. And so I said that to Dom. I said, play it a little bit more Chinese mandolin, and he knew what I meant, but you know, it was like a slur. Mm-hmm. But without me thinking about it as a slur, I was really not thinking about, you know, anything like that. And I heard Molly go ooh, and then I heard the other girls go oh, you know. I said Asian, and they went no, worse. I said, tell me what to say. Here's what I want to do. Here, tell me what to say. And it was an education for me. And it was so much fun though. I wondered what they would bring. The first record, see, we did, we had ringers come in, we had Ron Block, and you know, we just kind of cast it as we went along. But the second record was the band, you know, out on the road. When she told me she wanted to use the band, I said, well, you know, it's probably, it might take a little longer. I don't know what the studio savvy level is in the band. And when they got in there, though, there was no problem at all. No, we plowed a lot of ground. We turned over every rock. We went through all the vocals and, you know, and shortened some, you would shorten of, just do things like shorten one of those verses, you know, to use it later as a different part of the song, you know, and put a big fiddle cloud over it, you know, one of these things that I would create these big fiddle clouds of all these different violins coming from different directions. And it's just like a dark cloud setting down on something, you know. And so we decide to get that and decide where to use that. We were all in it. It was really fun. And then after we recorded, then we brought in the pedal boards and started going using the same stuff that they use on stage, you know, to color a solo, to put the banjo through an envelope filter, you know, do something crazy. And I loved working with them. They brought new ideas to me, and I was trying to muster everything I had to give them, because it's so good. It's so worthwhile. And they just all play so good. And they've almost, you know, started their own niche, you know, kind of musical genre, the way they play. I mean, it's glam grass, you know, it's like, it's almost like, it reminds me a little bit of like the 80s hair bands, but playing bluegrass. And it's like, you know, these beautiful people up there, and they're so good at everything they do. And it's just really, it's a phenomenon. It's right up there with Billy, you know, Billy Strings. It's so nice to see too. And I've always believed that every 15 to 20 years in bluegrass music, and probably every genre of music, there is a renaissance period. And I believe we're in one right now.
That's exciting. You know? Yeah.
I believe I was in a class of that. And then Chris Thiele was definitely in a class of that. You know, and Bela was in a class between us, but Sam was in a class just ahead of me, you know. But like I played with Earl Scruggs and Bill Monroe, but I play with Billy Strings. So what's, you know, it's a wide open field that is very inviting to all, you know. And it's what feels great to me is that after all of these things that I've done and played on all these records and done all these things, which doesn't really matter when it comes right down to jumping on the stage with somebody, who cares what you've done, you know. Mm-hmm. What you need to do is what you're going to do right then, you know. So it's great to get out, to be able to have done that, and to be able to play with, you know, walk out there with Billy, you know, in front of 40,000 people a night.
It's amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Let's talk about the new record, The Set. You have created this album to kind of mirror what a Jerry Douglas Band show might sound like, kind of like a collection of songs, not a compilation is what you're calling it, but they're, you know, you just put them all in one place, because some of these songs are on out of print records that you've like often will play at concerts. So you and the band really have like developed these songs on stage year after year after year. So what was it like to be able to take them into the studio and dig into them in that setting versus like on stage?
Well, one of the things that you find out when you go in the studio, no matter who you are, is that the format, whatever format you're recording to, that it does not lie. That is what you do. That's what you sound like. And and so the first thing to get used to there was to just getting used to the sound of our instruments in that environment, and not out on stage with the same ear mix that we use every night, you know. But playing the songs, then we could really get microscopic with our part, with each of our parts, and really sand out those the burrs, you know, that were giving us problems every night on stage, be able to actually work on that for a second. It could be really small thing, but it was just an indecision, you know.
I really like that phrase, sand out the burrs.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are a lot of times when you want to leave those there, though.
Yeah.
I know. I don't like hearing perfect. You know, perfect scares me. Almost perfect is all right.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because you say that there are some mistakes on this album, but you kept them in. Mm. You say they're not really mistakes; they're just different directions, which is quite a way to say it. So, like, how has it been for you, like your relationship to mistakes and imperfection, like over the course of your career through your musicality? Like when did you learn to like make friends with mistakes?
Recording. When I got into recording a lot and I found out, okay, here I get as many chances as I want, you know, as long as I don't burn a hole through the tape, you know, back in the magnetic days. But, on stage, you get one shot, and then it's history. You just move on. You know, it's like facing your troubles. You know, like, okay, here comes a problem. Okay, you recognize the problem and say, see you later. You know, bye. I got better things to do right now. And that's when you're on stage. It's just, you can't let that kind of thing bother you. But it will happen to you even in the studio. You'll play and you'll make some bobble, some mistake, you know, in the first third of the song that will stay with you all the way through that song, you know, unless you can shed it, because you know you can come back and do it again.
Mm.
So you're not too worried about the rest of it after that. You're only worried about that spot. So, you know, if you can forget about that and go ahead and produce a great track for the rest of the track, great. And probably can, but going back, and that's when it really made me get honest with being live, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Just trying to pull off things and wow, it's a different situation. It is a different mindset being in, but that's when I found out that it was okay to make a mistake.
Mm.
It's a snapshot. Even a record is a snapshot. You know, it's just where you are in that particular day.
Yeah.
You know, the next day you may have played it totally different. You may have not have used that song, you know?
It's like like an actual literal picture where you take a picture of yourself and 5 minutes later you look completely different in a different picture.
Right. Yeah. And it's in all of these records that, you know, I've been making solo records since 1976. 77, and they're all just, to me, I can say they're snapshots and go back and look at them and listen to them, and it's a snapshot. It's where I was right then, but I know that I've been so much better than that since then. Mm-hmm. You know, I've pulled it off. I've completed thoughts, you know, on how to do certain things.
Mm.
and over repetition sort of brought them into the muscle memory group.
Mm. I do wanted to ask you about a couple of the songs on here. Something You Got originally was on Traveler, your 2012 album, with one Eric Clapton singing lead. However, on the set, Jerry Douglas singing lead on the song, which is unusual. Jerry, you have a very nice voice.
Oh, thank you. I wondered what you were going to follow up unusual with.
Ah, well, you're always hanging out with like these amazing singers.
I know. Why would I sing?
Right. Alison Krauss, Dan Tominski. Yeah. Why would you sing? You're the world's best dobro player. But like, what about singing? Like, what does singing do for you that might be different from playing dobro?
It's the same thing. It comes from the same place. I mean, that's why it's, for me, it's impossible for me to play dobro with any substance, you know, and any appeal and sing at the same time. It just comes from the same place where I'm I'm dealing with pitch, phrasing, you know, and tuning, timing, all of those things. You know, you can't do them both from one place. I've seen violinists and people do it, but they're holding notes. They're not playing like a whole solo against singing. I mean, that's a split brain, man.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe it's possible, and I really want to see it. But if it's there, I want to see it. But oh God, I don't know where I was going with that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of all the fiddlers I know that sing.
Yeah, Tim O'Brien can pull it off.
Sarah Watkins.
Sarah Watkins can do it.
Yeah.
I mean, but they're either holding a one note or maybe a triad that's really ingrained in their soul.
They're chopping.
Yeah.
I've seen the chop and the sing. I'll have to pay attention.
That's what I do most of the time, because I know, you know, just I know where the chord is, because and it's you know, I'm playing with a slide, so it's all one big line.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to get in that area, but yeah, chopping, being percussive against it instead of trying to play the melody. But when I was a singer when I was a little kid, first off playing mandolin, I was singing. And playing the guitar, I was singing, but I had frets and I had positions to hold my fingers in, and I had the timing. That was not a problem. But then when I went to dobro, when the note became liquid, you know,
right,
and the vocal is liquid too, and so you're trying to match those up. And so when I got a band, I no longer had an Alison Krauss or a Dan Tominski or a Vince Gill. All of a sudden, I had nobody. So me. So I'll do it.
Me,
so
Jerry.
I've always, yeah, get in there and sing that song. But I always loved singing. I loved singing, but when I started playing dobro, it's all stopped. But I've sung different parts and background parts, you know, for lots of people. But that not playing at the same time, that's a different animal. But I loved singing. And so when it came time to have a singer, I was the singer and just started, you know, started building a repertoire, which is very slowly building. But I like instrumental records with vocal interruptions.
Yeah.
Instead of the other way around.
Yeah. Speaking of vocal interruptions, the song What Might Have Been features vocalizations from Eva O'Donovan. And I heard you say that as a session musician, you were instructed to stay off the same notes as the singer, just like perform around them. However, like on this song, What Might Have Been, you and Eva, it seems like you're hitting the same notes.
Exactly.
So what is the idea behind this rare occurrence of synchronicity between dobro and voice?
Well, that's the point of it, is for them to both be in the same octave, for the voice to emulate the guitar note, whatever the guitar note is. Mike Stern wrote that song, and I heard it, and he did it exactly the same way. I just totally ripped him off. It was just all this air. It was like the perfect voice to me. A dobro note with air and texture on it, you know, a texture kind of, you know, not glued to it, but just surrounding it, you know, and that's what Aoife did. She got it immediately when I said, I want you to do this. And, you know, it sounds like this. I let her hear the other record, but she did, you know, her own thing. I mean, there's not a word in the song. Mm-hmm. She sings all the way through, but never a word. They were all shapes and slides and lots of air. Mm. And her voice, that's her voice. Yeah, that's her, that's what she sounds like.
Do you know the guitarist Yasmin Williams?
She also
released her record this year with Aoife doing vocalizations.
Aoife's a popular gal.
You'll have to do a trio bill together.
She was with me in Transatlantic Sessions a couple years ago.
Cool. Oh my gosh. What a cool lady.
Aoife's been there too, but yeah. Yasmin. Yasmin. I've yet to actually play with, but we know each other really well. I was thinking of somebody else now, but Yasmin, yeah, I still have a track of hers here that I'm eventually going to finish. That it's so complicated. It's taking me so long to just a train of thought.
Yeah.
From
wow.
her. So I have to learn her train of thought, you know, and I love the idea. And that's sort of what Aoife had to do with against me on that mm-hmm. song. She had to not only know what the note was, but how, what the timing was and how, if I was going to slur the phrase or not, mm-hmm. you know, if I was going to change the phrase or, you know, hold it off like a quarter beat. You know,
yeah.
Those are things you can't count. You have yeah. to feel it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like you got to crawl inside the other person's brain.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like RFK and the worm.
All right. Before I let you go, would you like to do a very quick lightning round?
Sure.
Okay. Jerry Douglas, who is the hardest working person in bluegrass?
Jerry Douglas.
What advice would you give your teen self before you hit the road?
Never buy a cowboy hat with a roadkill on it.
Okay. What is your least favorite household chore?
Taking out the garbage.
Ooh. All right. I'm very passionate about taking out the garbage because it has to go. That's what I think. It has to get it out of here.
I know it has to go. I know. And then getting it to the road, that's even worse. Yeah.
Where are all your Grammys displayed?
They're they're all in a glass case in a very embarrassing place in my house that I walk by and don't look at. Right in my den, you know, in the den of the house. There are all these. Yeah,
nice. Great. Yeah. So company can see.
It's not my idea.
Who is your fashion icon?
Fashion icon. Oh, wow. What's his name? Chris. And he was out with Lyle Lovett last summer for a while.
Chris Isaak?
Yes.
Good one. Very slick.
Very slick. And I like it when he doesn't wear the really fancy suits. The other stuff he wears is very cool.
Awesome. This is the last one. What's for dinner tonight?
I have no idea. But I think it may be Indian food.
Oh, delicious.
That's what I've been thinking about.
Enjoy.
Mm.
Jerry, thank you so much for spending so much time with me today. I really enjoyed it. And congrats on the new record.
Thank you. Thank you. I enjoyed talking to you, too. Those are great questions. Let's talk again.
Okay. Done deal. This episode of Basic Folk was produced by Anthony Cabrera. Our music is composed by Dietrich Strauss. Basic Folk is a production of The Bluegrass Situation. You can find all of our episodes there, wherever you get podcasts. You can search for Basic Folk on the SiriusXM app. You can also search for us on FolkAlley.com or on Folk Alley's mobile app. Or you can check out our website, basicfolk.com. If you enjoyed this episode, you should share it with a friend, perhaps a friend that plays an unusual instrument, like a tuba or a bassoon or an upside-down bicycle trumpet. Send it to that friend. All right, we'll talk to you next time. Bye.